Unpack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. It's the Top Chef Judges Roundtable podcast here on reality TV. Wrap ups. Hey, everyone. Mike Bloom here, back again for yet another week of Top Chef 15. Killing our darlings. Man, very, very emotionally heavy episode from the chef's perspective, from a viewer's perspective, but we are here to break it all down for you. First, let me bring in here someone who has been week in and week out throughout season 15 of Top Chef. Someone who is angry enough to tackle someone in the end zone right now, Haley Strong. Haley, how you holding up?
I'm not even sure if I remember any of this episode because I just rage blacked out at the end.
All right, so this might be the some nice revelations from Haley, and we didn't even have a Canadian edit this episode. So
yeah, and it's not even like last week where I just straight up forgot to watch a part of the show. I did watch all of it. I just like I'm almost like in a tizzy. I can't like think of what's going on. Like it, even before I was like, what was even the quickfire? I couldn't even remember until I did a little research. Imagine that, doing some research for a podcast. I don't often do that, but
well, let's bring in somebody who is very well researched, especially about Top Chef. He is a flower of a person who knows a thing or two about tailgates. Please welcome back to the podcast, RHAP podcaster and OG member of the Top Chef Judges Roundtable, Antonio Mazzaro. Antonio, how are you doing?
Oh, thank you for that great introduction. I'm not sure what to make of it. Tailgates, flowers, I don't know, man. I don't know what you think of me that has caused you to come up with that, but we'll have a talk about that off air. No, thank you very much for having me back to this podcast that I was once such a much larger part of. Life finds a way to get in the way sometimes, but I'm so happy, as our great friend Kurt Clark is learning, I think, right now. But I'm so happy to be back, and I've really enjoyed listening to you guys throughout the season, and especially Haley with the Canadian adventures of maybe they're showing the whole episode, maybe they're not. I didn't realize I was missing content. I'm like cracking up laughing, and so maybe this is the week where they could have cut it off, and they could have cut some stuff out, and it would have been a much more
enjoyable episode for me. Haley. Yeah, it was painful. I'm not bearing the lead here. Fan fave, love of my life, Fatima got eliminated, and I'm just filled with rage and sorrow and just like all of the negative feelings that exist in
flames.
The world.
Flames out of the side of my face, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm just hurt. You know, I'm disappointed in Top Chef that this is the route they're going down, which is the route that doesn't go to what exactly I want, even though this was filmed like 5 months ago. So they should have really considered my feelings in this. And they did not, and for that I'm really going to have to reevaluate this relationship. And I just, you know, if they're going to do this to me, I don't know if I can keep doing this. Jokes. I mean, listen, I'm going to stick around, obviously. I'm just PO'd. I think lots of people are. We'll get there. We'll get there. Yeah, you know, so.
There's a lot to get through. We got a sudden death quickfire. We have a heartbreaking elimination. We've got a big taco bar filled LCK. I got another Top Chef event that I was very lucky to go to this past week that I'd like to talk about as well. But before we get into all that and the downfall of Joe Flam and fan favorite Fatima Triple F, Antonio, you've been following along all season long, but we haven't been able to get your opinions on Top Chef Colorado. What have you been thinking about the season so far?
I'm enjoying it. I think part of the reason why this is so an anger-inducing episode. And it wasn't just from us, obviously, the contestants, the chef testants themselves. You could see there was a lot of emotion in that sudden death quickfire. And with the elimination challenge as well. I think you said it, Mike, on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. I think you guys all pretty much agreed, though, that they reached a point in the season where you really liked everybody that was left. And I know we've said that about previous Top Chef seasons, but I think this certainly fits that bill. And I think the problem with that, of course, is when you set up a bunch of contestants who we all find to be mostly likable or very much likable, there are going to be moments like this. So the season in and of itself, I think the cast is really likable. Some people I thought could have done or would have done or should have done better in the competition were eliminated early. Some of them found their way back through Last Chance Kitchen or got some ability to show their skills off. It's certainly been a roller coaster ride of a season. I can't believe they made a pregnant woman sleep on a snow-filled mountain overnight. Like, I just the idea of it is, it just doesn't really, if you put it on paper like that, doesn't really sound very good. But I don't know. Other than that, the snow challenge was super memorable. That to me is something I will remember about this season, or it'll stand out. But the rest of the season, not so much. Like, there haven't been other great standout moments where I'm like, oh, I remember this Top Chef season because X happened. But I think we're in line for a pretty good finish here, hopefully. I don't know. The Last Chance Kitchen antics, I'm not like Josh Wigler in that I don't like Last Chance Kitchen. But this season was very interesting how they set that up with the previous chefs and with them kind of in heat going through. And then now everybody, we're wiping the slate clean and then we're bringing it back. And if you were someone like Kwame or Marcel or anybody, you know, Leanne or Jen, like, now you don't have to stick around. You don't have to sit in the kitchen. Like, you can leave now. So it's been a very interesting season. Top Chef has to take chances. They're so many seasons into their run. They're going to shake it up a little bit, and I'm fine with it. So I don't know. I'm still a great fan of Top Chef. I've watched every episode this season multiple times probably. So here I am.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up how you felt the only quote-unquote memorable challenge from a macro perspective is the outdoors challenge. And I wonder if it's because, I don't know, we get an elimination this challenge this episode that is focused around, you know, one of the big sports teams in the Colorado area. But maybe because that challenge is probably the most authentically quote-unquote Colorado of it, in that, you know, they try to do challenges based on the location. And not a lot of challenges this season have been really based around the Colorado culture or the environment. And that was one big example that, granted, might have negatively had an effect on one person standing in particular, but it definitely showcased, you know, why they were able to take advantage of Colorado as opposed to, okay, let's just go to a kitchen some other place in America and do all these other challenges.
Yeah, Denver is a pretty white bread city. So not to steal a word from Claudette, but
vanilla city.
It's not shocking. They haven't been able to find some kind of connection with real local existent culture. It's a burgeoning city, but it isn't exactly the most cosmopolitan. And this is coming from a Cincinnatian, so you know I mean it. It's not exactly the most cosmopolitan city, Denver, and they just have not found challenges, I think, that really, really resonate with me. And it's interesting because I'd like to go back and listen to on this podcast last year where we talked about...
Oh, you mean without me? Is that what you're trying to get at, Anton? Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
No, it's not. No. Oh, God, I feel terrible. No.
This is what you're in for, Antonio.
No, believe me, I know. I bought my ticket. I'm ready. And I've enjoyed it all season. I've cracking me up all season, so... I'm here for this. I don't know. I think that they possibly could have tapped into more there, but I don't know what that looks like at the end of the day.
Well, I thought that they were going to do something closer to what they did in the California season, which was like go all over the state, and maybe Colorado isn't as diverse as California is in that way. But I was kind of surprised that they stayed in Denver for all of it, except that mountain range one.
Yeah, so they went to Boulder for the mountain one, I believe.
I hardly know her.
This is why you come here. I love it. I'm here for it. I know they're going to Telluride. I think that's what they said on like the this season on. They might be going to Aspen for one challenge as well. So yeah, it's not as extensive travel as it was during the Texas season or the California season, where they're essentially being nomads the entire time. But let's get into the episode proper, because Haley, I'm sure you have an opinion on Joe Stash's Crystal Lovin, Crystal Blue Persuasion, perhaps.
I don't remember that part happening.
Don't know.
Are you sure this wasn't a longer episode for you guys?
maybe Canada has some really aggressive anti-New Age crystal laws in place that does not allow the exhibition of said hokum to be shown on TV. Yeah, Joe's got the crystals in his pocket. His girlfriend is...
I remember him
really
talking to his girlfriend.
Yeah, he opened that call by saying, like, I was doing really bad, babe, but then I moved the crystals into my other pocket, and then I did well. She was like, wow, it's great to hear.
Maybe I did see that. I will give a disclaimer. It was three glasses into a nice Chardonnay on Thursday night.
We should have podcasted immediately after the episode.
You know, I'm willing to do that. But oh, Mike was out being a cosmopolitan, sitting and dining with Curtis Stone while I had to be in my basement in rural Ontario drinking some shard by myself. At least it wasn't a boxed one like it was on Friday night.
Really, you are. This is the personification of first world problems right now, Haley. You realize that, right?
Haley, it sounds like you need to just realign your crystals. You know
what? I should think about that. Anyway, so I don't remember specifically the crystals part. Again, like I said, sorry, everyone, for my unprofessional tendencies, but that's who I am as a human. But I do remember him talking to his girlfriend, and that led me to believe, this doesn't seem great for Joe Stash.
Yeah, this we're going with like the Kirk Clark rules up. If they're talking about their cooking, they're fine. But if they start talking personal stuff, it might mean that they're going home. And I don't know, maybe Joe Stash has like accidentally put his crystals through the wash or something, because he did not get a lot of good juju coming his way this episode, Antonio.
Yeah, he needs to smudge his way out of this for sure. This is, I'm surprised he didn't go home. It seemed like Tom was surprised he didn't go home. It seemed like a lot of people were surprised that Mustache Joe didn't go home. He's done really well in the competition, obviously. He's got a couple wins under his belt. He has shown the ability to be technically gifted as well as creatively inspired. I think I've seen good things from him, but he's on a pretty bad run here. And the problem, I think, when you get to this point in the competition is you're talking about inches or millimeters instead of feet. It is, you could make a very small mistake and it could be very costly. Like, I don't want to jump ahead, but I'm sure some of the dishes that were on the slab for the elimination challenge were delicious. I'm confident that they tasted really good. I heard people saying they tasted really good. And yet people were sent home or were subject to that. So I think we're at the point in the competition where you can make very, very small mistakes and it matters. And certainly Joe Sasto had a day full of them.
The other thing that we get before we jump into the quick fire in terms of personal details is we check in with Bruce and his thoughts on young Jude. Now, Antonio, I would ask you, do you know Bruce? But I have a feeling like you know Bruce, considering that every time you look in the mirror, you probably see Bruce at this point.
Yeah, I see Bruce coming up to about nipple level on me. He's a much shorter man than I, Mike. I don't appreciate that. I think I've got about 6 or 7 or 8 inches height on Bruce here.
I'm glad you added height in there.
Yeah, listen, so am I. so am I. That was not an accident. This is definitely
not around these parts anyway.
I see. Don't speak of parts. I see ultimately Bruce when I look in the mirror a little bit. I do see that. And believe me, I want to eat that food. I wish that I could look in the mirror and watch myself cook meatballs and polenta like Bruce does for every challenge or many
pasta
challenges.
Pasta again, Antonio?
You're kidding me with this pasta and polenta. Let's get into the quick fire here with guest judge, 3 Michelin star chef David Kinch, who is going to come into play much more during the sudden death part of the quick fire, as we will see. But in true Bloom fashion, we are cooking with edible flowers, baby. Haley, do you have any stance on edible flowers? Is this something?
What the fuck did you just say? Are you quoting something?
No,
the baby is definitely not Mike's. So I know that for a fact.
I'm quoting Bruce when he got that phone call about Jude.
It's my baby.
It's my baby.
You know it. Okay.
Yeah, the making flowers challenge is a Mike Bloom challenge.
Oh, because his last name is Bloom? Oh my God. Haley, get your head in the game. How do I feel about edible flowers? Good. I think it was interesting. I thought it was fun. I don't eat a lot of flowers, but...
Have you ever eaten a flower? I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of what flowers I've eaten besides cauliflower, I guess.
I've had like a lavender creme brulee, which was stupid good. I would try a zucchini flower. I've heard those are good, like battered and deep fried, but again, you have to be careful because they soak up the oil. What else was there?
What about squash blossom dumps? Mike, have you ever eaten squash blossom dumps?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. Like, I feel like, I don't know if I've had squash blossom dumps, which, God, sounds like a horrible, like, grunge band name. But I feel like I probably had squash blossom at some point in my life. I do feel like if I had eaten any flowers, it's sort of in that blossom sprout like territory. What about you, Antonio?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I've eaten flowers, but I'm not a flower seeker. It's not something that I seek out. And it's interesting because they talked a lot about flowers as garnish, but then these people, I mean, this is involving the flowers directly in the thing, not just specifically as a garnish or something that is more, you know, not an integral part of the dish. It's something that I don't know. I don't seek it out, I guess. But I mean, I've seen it on menus. I'm sure I've had it. I've had flower-ish things on dishes. I mean, rose is something that gets included in dishes sometimes that I've had. I just see things, or I've probably had them, but more I think as a flavor element and not as a main element in the dish. So it was interesting. I don't think anybody seemed really taken aback by it. I know Chef CJ has established himself and really tried to spit game at Shailene Woodley, if I remember correctly, about foraging and using those sorts of things in cooking. And it seemed like Joe Sasto was into it too, even though he doesn't like basketball because the ball gets dirty when it bounces on the floor. He's willing to scrounge for food in public parks. So whatevs, bro.
He's such a weird man, I've realized over the course of this episode, between the crystal obsession and his possible OCD aspect with basketball, but also being someone
also the mustache.
And also, oh yeah, the mustache was probably the first indicator, but also possibly illegally putting flowers in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's proven himself to be an infinitely more interesting person just through this episode alone. But as these chefs are cooking, we see some stuff come out. Bruce is trying to channel his spirit noodle into bucatini. Unfortunately, he's not getting his extruder correctly, so he decides to go back to cavatelli, even though he knows he's made cavatelli before. What the hey, you know, gotta go with what you're given. And we also get some hashtag Joestash side eye going with Carrie, who decides to go with a traditional type of Carrie dish of a different take on a different take on a traditional dish with quote unquote fancy toast. Haley, have you ever had something akin to fancy toast before in your life?
No, because I'm not the biggest toast gal. When I toast my bread, I like it still pale. I feel like Carrie
sounds like that's the way Kurt would like it.
Probably. <Yes. laughs> Carrie is like a top chef savant. Like, she says these things and you're like, there's no way that's going to work. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, Carrie, you've won 4 quick fires in a row because you've done weird shit on toast. And this is another weird shit on toast from Carrie, as we got last week, question mark? Or the week before?
It was two weeks ago, the Brooke quick fire with the breakfast.
Yeah, Brooke's breakfast. This fancy toast, wow. I would eat it, yeah, absolutely. It sounds goat cheese on anything I'm like into, but I would be along with the other people, like hearing her be like, oh, I'm making toast at the final 6 or final 7 for a sudden death quick fire. You're like, what the shit are you doing, Carrie? And then she's like, guess what, I win.
I heard an F before the S in that word, Haley. I heard it.
This is a family podcast.
She put a salad on bread, and that was great. She had a little arugula in there, nice some nice rugs,
candied pecans,
the goat cheese, the walnuts, drizzled with honey. Like it sounded great. And toast was like, if I'm not mistaken, it was a little bit of a culinary trend for a while there. And
like avocado toast, I've never had avocado toast.
Do we not remember the toast sudden death quick fire that they did?
I don't want to talk about that because I don't know what you're talking about.
I've said this to Mike probably off air and maybe even on air. I can't remember what I say anymore. I hate sudden death quick fires.
Yeah.
They're just so anticlimactic, and it's just like, and Joe, we lost Joe, who had literally won the challenge like the night before, and then all of a sudden he's just gone because he didn't make fancy toast like Carrie did.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and especially this late in the competition, I don't think I mind so much if you've got the sudden death quickfire set up. And I know, like you said, you guys have talked about it, where it's a situation where if you pick somebody and you beat them, you stay in the competition, and if you lose, you go home. That is, I feel like, a little bit more in your control. I don't like this option where the bottom 3 go into a cook-off and then one of them goes home. And I'm okay with it, I guess, if it's a little earlier in the season. But this late in the season, you're right, Haley. Even though Last Chance Kitchen is in play, you're talking about somebody who won Restaurant Wars and then is coming into this challenge and loses immediately. That does feel anticlimactic. I don't think there's a different way to slice that. And I don't think that would change. I don't think my view of using a sudden death quickfire this late in the competition would change if someone else had gone home.
Because I like every single person here. Like, I would maybe be okay with losing Adrian here. Like, just slightly maybe. But everyone else, it just feels like such a disappointment because they've all had these great build-ups to this point, and they've had some highs and they've had some lows, but mostly they've been really solid. And all of a sudden, it's just like, peace out. Like, good luck in LCK if you make it.
Yeah, and I do think that I wonder how much the thinking on that sort of thing has changed since LCK came into being, because it does give people another opportunity to get back in the competition who probably mm-hmm. go home for some in a maybe seemingly unfair, difficult way. That said, you could point to Joe and say, you literally had two opportunities to cook your way out of this, and you did you cooked two bad dishes in a row. You didn't just cook one, but I don't know. He went home, I think, because he cooked the worst dish at least once, but maybe twice. But it was interesting to me that Joe Sasto cooks this buffalo cauliflower and completely puts it in the oven to smoke it and completely changes the dynamic of what he wanted to do. And even he's acknowledging that in his confessionals as he's plating it and things that are going forward there. But then later in the show, Tom says to him, you know, you almost went home, right? I'm like, well, what did he have to do to go home? Like, if putting the cauliflower in the oven and making it inedible and making you hate it was not enough to send him home, like, what did Joe Flam really do that was so bad if Joe Sasto was still in the competition? So I don't know. It's always difficult to judge what was happening. And as I said, Joe Sasto has shown a lot of skill, but so has everyone else that was in that bottom three. So mm-hmm. it's really hard to say how it was fair to any of the three of them, as you were saying.
What I will say is, give me a sudden death quickfire over what they used to do with just, okay, if you were our least favorite dish in the quickfire, you go home. I like this option of at least giving them a second chance, because like you said, Antonio, Joe Flam had a chance to save himself. We also have this odd track record with sudden death quickfires, and I do want to sort of get into the first flour-based dishes proper before we dive into the sudden death quickfire proper. But it seems like sudden death quickfires have just been big misses from a cooking perspective just for this season. Let's remember that the first sudden death quickfire was the omelet off between Rogelio and Laura and Tanya, and none of them did well. And once again, we get a cauliflower off between Chris and the two Joes, and none of them do really well. I'm not entirely sure what it is. Maybe it's the additional pressure. Maybe it's just something going on in the Colorado air, the lack of the high altitude. I'm not entirely sure, but sudden death quickfires from a pure cookery perspective have not necessarily been hitting. But let's get back to these flour dishes. Carrie's going to win, and we're going to see the two Joes and Chris again in the bottom three. Antonio, did any of these dishes stand out to you for one reason or another?
In the bottom three, you mean?
Of any of the seven.
Oh, I mean, the Carrie's dish, it looked great, and it sounded great, and I would eat it for sure. It sounded really, really good. I really want to eat Bruce's pasta. I mean, bucatini, capitelli, whatever it is, or cavatelli, whatever it is, I'm here for it. But Carrie's dish really jumped out to me. I don't know. It's difficult because it's hard to say. This is a competition, I think, where, because you're talking about that flour element and because they do add a key flavor element, a dish could have looked great and tasted terrible. And I just wouldn't have known, you know, so it's hard to say other than that. But Carrie's dish really did seem like something I would have got. I mean, if you told me I could get that before having pizza or something at a restaurant, I'm like, I'm in. I'll eat bread with goat cheese and figs and drizzled honey and arugula. And it just sounded really good.
What about you, Haley?
I would have gone with Fatima's lamb. Ooh, it looks so good. Even just staring at the picture now, I'm like, oh my God, I want that.
Yeah, and the interesting combination of the oranges with the chilies like Padma. I've never had that combination before, but it sounds really, really interesting. And unfortunately, this will be, you know, the best Fatima's going to be doing in this episode.
Why even bring it up?
I know, it's an eventuality, but those two looked really good. In particular, the Padma comment that we alluded to towards Bruce was also very interesting. I don't want to get into the winner discussion of it all, but I mean, they're highlighting here, Antonio, Padma is vocalizing the fact that Bruce Bruce makes a lot of pasta. To be a Top Chef winner, do you necessarily need to tout a diverse level of cuisine? Or do you think there's a chance Bruce could get to the end and win despite staying in his wheelhouse making polenta and making pasta?
I think if Bruce gets to the end, he absolutely could win, because I have zero doubt that what Bruce is good at, he's really, really, really good at. That seems to be what people have said throughout. It seems to be the cross system feedback on Bruce is that Bruce is good at what he does, but he doesn't do a lot of the things that maybe are what you need to carry through the competition. He doesn't have that wider array, or he probably does have it. I mean, this is an experienced guy, but I think it was Tanya earlier in the season who, when she was cooking the lamb, she knew by touch, because she was a skilled chef, how the meat needed to be cooked. She just didn't say the right number because it's not on her menu. It's not something that she does. Even though she knows how to do it, it's not something she has experience with on a moment-to-moment basis. And I think where we've seen Bruce do best during this competition is when he's cooking his food, the things he does very commonly. But there are challenges where if you try to square peg your food into the round hole of the challenge, it's not going to work. And I think this was definitely one of them. There were people that were more abject than Bruce in this challenge, or that committed sins that were greater in the eyes of the judges, for sure. But we're getting to late days here where that's not going to be the case. That said, the later you get into the competition, the more the ability to cook your own food and cook it really well becomes significant. And I got to say, contrast Bruce to Chris. Chris is a guy who also has his own style and who also cooks his own food. But Chris has shown, I think, a breadth and a depth to his cuisine that Bruce has struggled with in the competition. And I think Bruce has probably been in his own head a lot. And I think the comment from Padma doesn't help Bruce get out of his own head to an extent, because we saw Bruce struggle earlier in the competition, and he's got that moment where he says, "I get it now." And he's done really well since then. But I do think that he's done well by doing his own food. And there are going to be times where you have to just adapt and evolve. And I think that the competition of Top Chef wants to showcase people who can do that. And I think that ultimately Bruce's only real hurdle is going to be getting to the end. If he gets there, I think he can put together the meal of his life that's going to really impress the judges.
And Joe Stash also sort of gets his "I get it now" moment, because he gets a critique from David Kinch that they pull out the P word. They say that, Joe stuffed squash blossoms is very pedestrian and not used very creatively. And so that fuels Joe's fire, his wood fire grill, quite literally, to say, okay, I'm going to make this cauliflower a different way. So moving into the sudden death quick fire, they're pulling out a different type of flour. Tom's coming out with a bunch of cauliflower. He talks about how it's making a comeback. I know that firsthand because I went to Tom's restaurant and he has cauliflower as one of these staple vegetables that goes with basically every dish on his menu. So he is definitely touting that first and foremost. So they have to create a dish with subbing out one ingredient and putting cauliflower in there. Joe Stash goes for the aforementioned smoked cauliflower buffalo wings. Joe's Flam goes for a purple cauliflower risotto. And Chris goes for a cauliflower caponata. And Joe Flam really gets pegged here because David Kinch makes a risotto using I don't think it was cauliflower, but subbing out another ingredient for it in his restaurant. Joe Flam doesn't realize this and is almost unintentionally sort of aping the dish that David Kinch has on his menu. Haley, when you saw that, did you think that that would be such a negative indicator of Flam's performance as it ended up being?
I thought it was a bold move to go for risotto using an ingredient you don't normally make risotto with so soon after he already failed making risotto out of ingredients that you don't normally make risotto out of in a quick fire. Like, you would think of learning your lesson, but
yeah. I mean, it's a step above the banana oatmeal with salt risotto, but this is still not a great one.
I didn't think this would be the end of Joe here. But I think they made the right choice based on the dishes that were made.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree, Antonio?
Yeah, it's weird because I think you pointed out, I mean, as you're pointing out, Mike, like the fact that the chef has that dish on his menu and it's not cauliflower. I see riced cauliflower all the time. I mean, I've eaten it before, and I wonder why Flam didn't prep it that way. It's interesting because we were talking just a moment ago about Bruce and cooking his own food. Flam is cooking a dish he's never cooked before. And I don't know if he was in his own head or what he was doing there. But if you look at that, the hit on him was in the prep. He didn't chop the cauliflower correctly. And I just don't know. I don't know what was going on there. Tom still wanted to send Joe Sasto home. But it was Padma and it was Judge Kinch who ultimately made the decision to send Joe Flam home. And it really did seem to rest on the fact that he just didn't like Rice's cauliflower. He had big chunks of cauliflower in his risotto. And that's I don't know if that's an instance like on Top Chef where you change the name of the dish and maybe people don't send you home for it. But it didn't look like risotto when I looked at it. That's for sure.
Yeah, he definitely kinched it with the way he prepared that risotto, unfortunately.
Oh, boy. Oh boy.
Well, it's interesting as well because this is not a great episode for Tom in terms of the happy, upbeat Tom we see sometimes.
I feel like this was a bad episode for every single person involved.
Except for Carrie.
Except for Carrie somehow. She seems to just kind of like rise out of everything with a smile on her face. But I just feel like just everyone here just was kind of off.
Do you think then, Haley, that this says that Carrie is Carrie the clubhouse favorite? I know there's that moment in this episode where everyone's talking about how Carrie's the clubhouse favorite. Do you read it that way?
I don't necessarily read it that way, even, which is crazy because every week we get someone sends us this kind of like infographic about who's winning challenges and who's in the bottom. And Carrie has the best average out of everyone there. She's won the most things and she's been in the bottom the least amount of times or something like that, which is crazy because I don't think if you asked any of us, the first one who comes to our mind when we're like, oh, who's doing super well, I don't think any of us would be like, Carrie is just killing this thing.
Well, I would say that before this episode, between the highlighted package that you mentioned and the fact that Carrie does the thing that's very rare on Top Chef of the dual quick fire elimination wins in the course of one episode. Granted, this was sort of a team challenge, but at least from my perspective, I know that we sort of have preached the wide open field, and I still think that this is a pretty wide open field, but I have definitely nudged Carrie forward at this point as who I think is the favorite to win, just because she has a defined aesthetic and she's good at that aesthetic. And like Antonio was talking about before, maybe unlike someone like Bruce, it's a pliable aesthetic that can be applied to really sort of any challenge that comes their way.
Yeah, and no one's really clocking her for doing the same thing over and over because she is putting a twist on everything. It's not just pasta and polenta all the time. She's doing interesting things with potatoes and like she's had a bunch of potato dishes and no one said, potatoes again, Carrie.
Which is a sentence I've never even said in my life. So that's
who would? But
you'd have to know someone named Carrie first of all, and then they would have to make a lot of potatoes for you. It's just an unlikely scenario. Yeah, I don't know. I usually look at, and this has nothing to do with her with Carrie, except for the fact that she's local. I usually look at the token one or two local chefs in the competition and think, they're there because they're local. And it's hard to think. I'm sure that there are several examples from the history of Top Chef where you've got the local cast member and they do really, really, really well. And sometimes the local cast member is someone like Philip Franklin Lee from the California season, who is clearly there because they represent some very specific element of the food movement in that area or what they're cooking from. And I guess there have been Top
Chef
Texas.
I didn't realize that insanity was a food movement, but
I can't believe me. And parts of California, I'm sure that it is. you look no further than Golden Gate Park. But yeah, I think that the Texas season maybe had some standouts or people that were local, but I think Sarah Grunberg, I think that was her name, did pretty well in the competition and was from Texas, but was also Chicago adjacent or had moved around.
Yeah, she was Chicago based.
Yeah, so it's weird that I normally look at the local person that's in the cast and think, I'm sure they're a good chef, but they're not necessarily in the cast because they're so good. The element of them being local is a huge reason why they're here. And I thought that about Carrie and Brother from the beginning of this season. And I've been pleasantly surprised, certainly by Carrie, but also by Brother at the skill and the pliable skill. I think, Mike, you're right. And I don't know why Carrie wouldn't be the clubhouse leader at this point. she does everything correctly and she doesn't seem to get dinged for it. In the Restaurant Wars episode, she, just like Chris, was ceding control. She's taking a backseat. She's smiling and just putting her head down and getting the work done. And nobody is hammering her for that. When she wins this quick fire and she gets the first, she gets to put the teams together, I think she makes the exact right calls. We can talk about that from a game theory perspective, but her pick was perfect and they won. And they won not just because they cooked good food, but because she made that happen and put the two of them together. So I think she's doing everything right. I'm really impressed with her.
So to go back to your question of, you know, how hometown people do, the one that really sticks out to me, and if others have examples, feel free to let us know. But Stephanie from Chicago, I believe she was a Chicago girl when she was on the season. And so I think that's probably the biggest example, though, again, maybe there are some other
10 years ago, right? 10 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Let's send off Joe Flam a little bit here. I feel bad that Kurt is not here to send him off, considering that he was the very, not only his first pick, but the very first pick of our draft at the end of episode one. I'll admit, seemed like a little bit of a WTF choice at the time, at least from my perspective, but I've really grown to enjoy Joe Flam as a person. I think he is so deadpan and hysterical in the confessionals. And we also have the added effect where you could just see these chefs' hearts breaking as Joe Flam was eliminated.
Fatima was sobbing.
Yeah, I feel like it's very rare that we've seen casts that are close before. Heck, we had Jim on last week and he talked about how the Top Chef 14 cast is still sort of in a group thread. But I don't know, maybe I'm misremembering, but it feels like it's been a while since we've seen people get that emotional over another chef's elimination, that they're crying over the fact that somebody went home.
Haley, has anyone said Flam Bay yet?
Ooh, I don't think so. Nor have we said like, oh, do you want some flam for dessert? Like a, you know, like a flan.
Yeah, I mean that he seems like a genuinely good guy, and it's it seems like it bears out. You guys have talked about
bears. I get it.
You guys have talked about what Fatima has been going through with her illness, and I know she posted a pic of Joe visiting her in the hospital, and you sense that closeness was real, and you get to, during the challenge, during the sudden death part, Adrian is saying like, I really like Chris and Joe Sasto, but I really like Joe Flam, and I'm really rooting for him. And like, she's calling out advice to him. It just seems like he's across the board, really, really well liked guy. And
he just seems like a cool dude.
Yeah. He just seems like a decent person, and he seems like a really good chef too. So lucky Kurt, I guess, that Kurt can just butter up the people that live in the same town as him. I'm sure that'll work out to his benefit at some point.
Yeah. But only one of us around here has actually eaten his food. Looking at you, Michael.
That's true. And he's a really good chef too. He made a fantastic dish. So we'll talk more about him in LCK. Spoiler alert, I think he might have a good chance of doing well in LCK just because he's a really good chef and he just had a rare misstep here. But let's segue into the elimination challenge as goodbye, David Kinch. Hello, barbecue master Adam Perry Lang. Surprise, surprise, Bruce knows him. But it looks like this is one of those rare times when maybe that worked against him here, Haley.
Yeah, gosh, it's so funny. It's so funny, the storyline of knowing and not knowing, because then you can get judged pretty harshly. Like, hey, this isn't your best, and I know that.
Yeah, it's sort of like cuts both ways. And it seems like, we've seen it before, and I feel like it hasn't really had any sort of negative connotation to it. And granted, it doesn't really here, even though Bruce is going to fall into the bottom. He pretty much gets shrugged off right away by everyone saying, no, he still cooked a pretty good meal. But Antonio, it doesn't seem like it's been a good luck charm for Bruce to necessarily know these guest judges.
No, it's certainly a blessing and it can be a curse. And the thing about Bruce, and it's certainly a mark in his favor, we've seen a lot of times in the past, it's a five hole to give Jessica Lee's credit for her catchphrase or her trademark there. You oftentimes, when you're cooking for somebody that was a mentor or that you know really well or that you really admire, you end up taking a bath. You end up doing really poorly and you make a mistake or you screw it up. And it doesn't seem like that, knowing the judges, has caused Bruce to really change how he's doing what he's doing. He seems to be a pretty level-headed, emotionally mature guy about all these people that he knows or people that he's friends with. And it doesn't seem like knowing the judges is really causing him any stress or strife, which we've seen take down so many people in the show in the past. So it is a blessing and a curse, but Bruce is managing it pretty well. And I think we see the flip side of that, because it also pays off for Carrie in this episode.
So the elimination challenge, we're going back outside. They're going to work in teams of two, or in one case, just happen to be wearing the same color, but happen to cook separate dishes to create one plate of food for a tailgate Super Bowl party in honor of the Denver Broncos, who are not in the Super Bowl, but there is one convenient team that is that we are going to be talking about. You mentioned this before, Antonio, but Carrie gets to delineate the teams for winning the quickfire. She chooses herself and Chris, Joe Sasto and Adrian, and Fatima and Bruce. Haley, looking at these three teams on paper before the challenge even started, did you have an odds-on favorite between these three pairs in terms of their chemistry?
Yeah, I thought Bruce and Fatima was that was a really good pairing, I thought, for both of them. And I thought they were going to do super well together, create an awesome dish, and probably win. But that wasn't the case.
This is the second time, if I'm not mistaken, and it might be the third time, that Bruce gets set up on a team with somebody and they don't work well together. It's not a Claudette situation. I'm not going to, as Adrian would say, put a check mark on their report card. But I'm thinking of Rogelio cooking the salad, trying to bring the team's menu together at the food truck challenge, and Bruce just being like, you do you, boo-boo, like just letting the person do what they want and not really taking the leadership or trying to make something harmonious happen, just kind of doing his own thing separate from the team, and it ends up costing the team. And I do think that's what happened here. So we'll get into that for sure.
Did they not understand that challenge at first? Because I don't know if I did either. When they said that they were making two separate dishes, I was like, oh yeah, sure. But then when, you know, the other two teams were like, yeah, we're making one dish, I was like, what? Why are they doing that?
No, I was very confused about this as well. And I'll, you know, spoil a bit of, I got to interview both Joe Flam and Fatima, who were both eliminated this week for Parade. I haven't written up the articles yet, but I did ask Fatima about, you know, why they decided to go for separate dishes rather than saying, okay, let's collaborate on one plate together. And Fatima really chalked it up to the fact that she was very much out of her element. As she talks about, she had never been to a football game in her life. She has been to a football stadium once, which I'll take a second to talk about this absolutely hysterical confessional between Fatima and Bruce.
Have you ever been to a football stadium? No. Wait, once for a concert. For Taylor Swift. Which one? The 1989 tour, duh. No, which stadium?
It's like the Top Chef version of Who's On First. I absolutely loved it.
Yes.
She basically, at least what she told me was that, you know, she felt like she was so uncomfortable in exactly what quote unquote tailgate food is that she sort of decided to take Bruce's lead. And Bruce sort of came in with this weird perspective of, oh, usually a tailgate is like a potluck where you grab a bunch of different things. So therefore we can put two different things on the plate that don't really mesh together and it'll be okay because it'll be with the tailgate aesthetic. Granted, that really does not play well. And I totally agree. When they first started doing that, I'm like, the rule said one plate. Like they can still be on the same plate, but these feel like two separate dishes. And I have to feel like that's what ultimately did them in.
It wasn't great. And, you know, the fact of the matter is you can have one plate and that plate can have ribs and fried mac and cheese on it. It doesn't have to be a situation where you only make one item like Chris and Carrie did. I think you can make one plate that has multiple things on it, but they should be harmonious. They should go together. And I think Bruce recognizes, even as they're conceptualizing their dish, that it's not harmonious, that she's making nachos, I'm going to do
but then
steak.
Why wouldn't he say something? Why wouldn't either of them say something? And like, I'm probably being way too soft on Fatima because I'm biased and I love her. But Bruce, as the super experienced chef, why wouldn't he be like, you know what? That's probably not the way to go. Why don't we try this instead?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that you could make that criticism of Bruce. And I don't know if they did. If he might have said it. I mean, we're watching an edited TV show. There could have been a lot of discussion about that when they were menu planning or when that was going down. What we got instead was Bruce telling Fatima that the colors of the Broncos were blue and orange and suggesting that she use blue corn tortilla chips. So I don't know. He clearly was concerned about it, but I think his problem was he couldn't see a way where he would feel comfortable and protected if he worked his way into that dish, and that she didn't know really what tailgate food was. So she was set on nachos.
But why didn't he say no?
Listen, ours is not your reason why. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he didn't want to go home and he's okay with what happened. I mean, some of this is defensive.
But he doesn't seem like the type of guy to be like, and like, I don't, obviously I don't know him like everyone else does, but it just doesn't seem like he'd be the type of guy to throw someone under the bus, especially someone like Fatima, who he's had a very good relationship with.
Yeah, he seems like a good guy, but that, I mean, you can be a good person and not feel the need to go the extra mile and to put everything. I mean, we've seen that in Top Chef, where the quote unquote good person decides it's their fault and decides to take on all the responsibility for
We saw that last week.
Right. Yeah, good point. Someone else's inconsistencies or someone else's deficiencies or someone else's problems.
But there's a difference between that and, like, they were a team. They were being judged as two. Chris and Carrie both got a prize for winning.
Yeah, it would have been very interesting to see. I think that's a great point. It would have been very interesting to see.
It would have been different if they were two separate parts of the same team.
Get rid of the sudden death quickfire in this episode and say the losing team goes home. And then see how Bruce cooks and see what he chooses to plate in that scenario. I bet you it's not the same thing.
Well, let's get into some of these other teams planning as well. So we start hearing a little bit about Chris and Carrie going for the Bronco Pooter, which sounds like another 90s grunge band, a little bit of a take on poutine. Adrian and Joe are going for some St. Louis style ribs. Adrian admits, hey, you know, maybe making ribs for a barbecue master is not a great idea, but I'm going to try to impress him. Your results may vary on that. I want to go back to the poutine for a second. Since Haley, you are a resident Canadian, give me your like play-by-play thoughts when first you hear that they're doing poutine, and then you hear that they're not going to use cheese curds in said poutine.
I was very excited, and then I was very angry. This episode was all about, you know, what can we do to make Haley the most upset possible? Cheese curds are an essential part of a poutine. You do not have a proper poutine if you don't have cheese curds. I don't care what else you put on this poutine. You could put, like a full duck just sitting on the poutine, as long as you have fries, cheese curds, and gravy.
Is the duck alive in that scenario?
Yes, it is. It's just sitting there hanging out, sharing the poutine with you.
It's French fries and gravy, sir. Haley, I told you off air that my first Canadian experiences were in Windsor, Canada, which I believe Canada thinks of as an armpit. But I had poutine there for the first time. Delicious. So I know cheese curds are a fundamental part of the thing.
They're the best part. Oh, I was so mad. And I was like almost offended too, because Carrie was like, oh, we don't need cheese curds. It's like, fuck you. Yes, you do.
All right. This is no longer a family podcast. You really tried to hold off at the beginning, and then you're letting it fly, much like Carrie lets fly a lasso when she was a kid and she was barrel racing and pole bending and goat tying.
Game changer. She's a game changer. No doubt about it.
Yeah, much like another fan favorite contestant from another reality show. She barrel raced. I love that photo, though. That was so goobery, but it was so much fun to see. And then contrast that with Joe Sasto's aforementioned, I don't like basketball because the ball hits the ground too much, confessional.
I think I missed both those things. Again, not sure if it was the wine or they didn't show it.
They give you the anti, you stayed for the anti-poutine stuff, but you left for the slice of life moments that thankfully it's just nice to see someone from the Bay Area who doesn't like the Golden State Warriors. I'm a big fan of that. Go Thunder, Thunder up. But yeah, I feel bad. The thing I think that you're hitting on, Haley, is that she said that she wanted to elevate poutine and that by getting rid of the cheese curd, she was making it more elegant.
But that's not, no, like, no, that's not how you make a poutine more elegant.
Yeah.
You hand cut your fries. You use like duck gravy, but you don't
set a live duck on top. Yeah.
You don't take out the cheese curds. You could even do like, cause I know they make like a buffalo cheese curd where it's like super spicy. Put something like that if you want to elevate it. But like, you have to make the dish what it is. Like, you can't make a fake poutine and call it a poutine. That's not how it works here in Canada, sir.
She even acknowledged her own realness or ridiculousness when she said nacho cheese is more elegant. Is that a sentence anyone has ever said? Like,
nacho cheese is gross.
Yeah, it's nacho cheese. It's certainly not elegant. And I don't know. But yeah, that was not a funny joke. Don't laugh at that.
Well, let's get into the next day. And I guess the declared Top Chef day in Denver, complete with street sign. First of all, Antonio, I know you're a football person. Did you recognize most of the players that were gallivanting around the tailgate before they went off to, I guess, go play?
You, sir, are incorrect. I've watched very little NFL this year. I'm completely out. And it has nothing to do with the politics of the league. That it has everything to do with the violence of the sport and the inability of the sport or lack of desire to address it. But I'll get off my high horse and just say it was Top Chef Day in Denver when they gave them giant tax breaks to film there. I think it's hilarious that they decided to go the extra mile and give them the extra mile high and give them everything. Yeah, the kicker, Brandon McManus, was there. TJ Ward is there, who is speaking of the violence of the NFL, an absolutely abjectly dirty player. Not the kind of guy that you want to feature on your show, I don't think. He's a headhunter.
Yeah, just remember that this show had Logan Paul on a couple weeks ago. And
fair play. Yeah. Yeah. Fair play. Fair play. Good point. Good point. I was not for that either. And neither was Tom. That was one of my highlights of the season, because you could just tell that Tom hated Logan Paul. So and I didn't. Mike, do you know if that had any impact on the ratings of the show?
This is one of those rare moments as well where you sort of, in the Logan Paul way, you get like the non-chef people coming in to judge the food. And for what it's worth, it seemed like them and the mayor all seemed to enjoy the food overall, even though Tom did not.
Yeah, one of my least favorite people that they show on Top Chef are the people who attend the tastings and they comment like the judges. I always like it when they have people who attend the tastings or who attend the challenges and who don't comment like the judges, who just say the unrefined, like, I like my grandma's mac and cheese kind of thing. Like, I actually prefer those people to be the people who are part of the group than not. I definitely don't like when random Top Chef fans turn up and start talking about the layering of flavor and stuff like that and using the Top Chef judge vernacular. I much prefer the people who don't really know food coming in and just talking, because, and this is a thing that Adrian was dinged for earlier in the season. Chefs should cook their own food. They shouldn't cook for their audience. And so I really do like, ultimately, when you see an audience that isn't the typical audience come in. And I really appreciate hearing their comments about it. And especially in the realm of a tailgate, it is interesting to me that Tom Colicchio did not like any of the dishes, it seemed like. He said nobody really hit, like, I forget what his verbiage was, but he wasn't really impressed with anyone's efforts at the tailgate.
I believe he said, I don't see a Super Bowl champion.
Yeah, but I do wonder, like, how pleased would the attendees of the event have been if they went a fully, like, elevated, fully chefy tailgate meal that would have pleased Tom Colicchio and would have shown off their great skill, but would it have pleased the judges? It's funny, I saw a tweet today completely unrelated to Top Chef and totally related to the Super Bowl that said, don't be the person who brings buffalo cauliflower to your Super Bowl party. That isn't food. And I thought to myself, that's hilarious, because it perfectly encapsulates the Top Chef dilemma at an event like this. So I liked having the football players there and remarking upon what they were eating, because I'm probably more like them than I am like the judges. So I'm more interested in what their feedback was, for sure.
I was going to say, Haley, as someone who has been in one of those situations, as someone who has attended a Top Chef challenge to taste things, do you agree with Antonio?
Yeah, I could totally see where Antonio's coming from, because more often than not, when you're cooking in a restaurant or in one of these situations, it's going to be people who, you know, don't always know what a batonet is.
Yeah, to be fair, according to Joe Flam, nobody has done a batonet in years, so that pretty much is everyone except for Adrian.
Yeah, so I do like seeing this more low-key food, and I honestly thought everything looked pretty good.
Yeah, I don't want to go to, let's say, a Broadway show and see costumes that are exactly what I expect. I want to see impressive sets. I want to see things that I couldn't contemplate, but I want to see it in a way that is still pleasing to me. There is a level where that's a turnoff. Like, I don't, and I'm not, this is not a diss. Like, I don't watch shows like Project Runway or that involve design of fashion, because I don't get it. I can't appreciate what it is about something that is truly great. But then there are people who are so good at what they do, who are true artists, that I can appreciate it. That I can look at that and say, I have no idea what makes a good design, but I can tell you that I'm seeing one right now. And I think that if you're talking about an audience, I think that the sweet spot for this challenge is you've got an audience whose expectations are tailgate food. And I can see where someone like Fatima, who's not familiar with what their expectations would be, starting really struggling with that. But I think what you're meant to do, if you're a true artist, if you're a true chef here, is put something that will meet their expectations, exceed it, and also be something that is exceptional, that is not what they expected. You can't just come out and cook, you know, pretty standard food and expect to impress Tom Colicchio and Brandon McManus. I think you have to do something that is the sweet spot is that is something that Brandon McManus would be like, I never eat this. I would never have thought this was good. It was phenomenal. And Tom to say that was what we were looking for. Like, I just don't think anybody really threaded that needle. The poutine seemed pretty close, but even again, we have problems with that, as Haley has so perfectly articulated.
Yeah, well, let's get into that. Since there are such few dishes in this challenge, I feel like we can get a little more granular and break things down dish by dish. And let's start with the winning dish, which ends up being Carrie and Chris's pork green chili poutine with stadium fries. And even though Haley has some protests against it, it seemed like the judges really enjoyed it. You know, they said it was really flavorful and that each chili really gave a different type of flavor. I believe they said it screamed Denver, which is good. It was probably the loudest dish there. Haley, by the time that you actually saw the dish, were you a little warmed over by the lack of cheese curds, or was that still stinging for you?
No, it still stings for me a little bit. But if I'm staring at it right now, which I am, and like pretending that it had cheese curds instead of nacho cheese, like, this looks delicious. There's cilantro on it. You know, there's some like green chili, which is really making it like interesting. The fries themselves look really cool. They're not like your typical fry. They almost look like a steak cut. It looks delicious. And that is what I want at like a sporting event or something like this.
Yeah, it seemed like it was. The nachos, you could tell, were going to be problematic. And I seemed like they set up that the ribs would be problematic as well. At the end of the day, they seemed to be okay. They certainly made the mac and cheese look problematic, and it was. But so it was almost like, this one stood out because the other two really were seemingly problematic. I thought it was funny that Graham Elliott liked the moistness of the butt. That's something I guess you can get away with saying. I don't know. I was like, oh man, Graham Elliott going full bloom here. It seemed like Padma said elevated tailgating. So I just think that the best thing about this is that Chris was clearly an Eagles fan. At the time this was filmed, had no contemplation that winning a trip for two to the Super Bowl would mean getting to watch his team play in that Super Bowl that he won. So this was certainly a serendipity for Top Chef that an Eagles fan won two tickets to see the Eagles play in the Super Bowl. I thought that was pretty awesome.
And I wonder if that wasn't the case, if they would have featured that as much. You know, like maybe there were other people who had football teams that just didn't make the Super Bowl. And maybe if they had made it instead, they would have edited it in. But yeah, it's fantastically convenient that he is touting like, I'm an Eagles fan. He's begrudgingly becomes a Broncos fan for this one challenge. But he ends up winning a trip to the Super Bowl that his team is going to be in. It's absolutely fantastic. And I'm so happy that Chris gets to go. Hopefully we'll get some like social media follow up as to, no matter how the game goes.
Mike, he doesn't even know. The man doesn't even know what a hashtag is.
He was just kidding about that. He knows, but he did a whole video for Tasty. Let's move on to these separated dishes here that Bruce and Fatima sort of share on one plate. Let's start with Bruce's grilled sirloin steak with bread and butter, beet salad, and horseradish aioli. Now, again, Bruce sort of gets the easily excused once he ends up sort of being sent to the detention center of the bottom. And I can understand why it seemed like the steak was a good cook. It seemed like a fine dish overall. This, to me, just did not seem very tailgatey. I do not obviously attend very many tailgates, but I can't imagine that like a steak salad is something that's frequented there. Haley, do you disagree?
No, not at all. It didn't make sense to me that this was the scoop here. A lot of tailgating, I don't think you're bringing a whole lot of forks and knives. So to have like a steak and like something you kind of had to cut, this didn't really make a whole lot of sense. I thought the nachos made way more sense, but obviously they didn't really work in practice as much as the poutine, I guess. But it just seemed like an odd choice. And so maybe Bruce didn't really get what was going on either. So he couldn't have told Fatima like, hey, this isn't a good idea, because he didn't really know it was a good idea either.
Mm-hmm. Antonio, what did you think about Bruce's performance here?
I'm still hung up on you don't really tailgate much, and I'm wondering what is the event that would bring you out to a tailgate? What would you tailgate for, Mike?
Oh, I would totally do that Billy on the Street sketch you did where I think they tailgated a Wicked performance. Like, I would be there 100%.
So what, you have like plastic cups of red wine and like some finger food canapé? Like,
yeah,
what are we doing?
And then we, instead of chanting, we would instead sing the songs outside before we wait to go in. Like, I am all for that. Broadway League, make that happen. I am there, and maybe I'll bring some green nachos in honor of the show.
And tailgates are tough. I think you're defying the gravity of this situation ultimately, because it is it's you're right, Haley, that you don't want cumbersome tailgate food. You don't have to look at me in the mirror or otherwise to know that I'm a guy who's tailgated plenty of my day. I've had good tailgate experiences. I've had some not so good tailgate experiences, one of which involved me waking up on the floor of a bathroom stall at a football stadium, not remembering how I got there. It probably involved alcohol, but it's neither here nor there. The point, the longer point is, I've eaten a lot of tailgate food. I've seen really elevated tailgate food, and by that I don't mean fine dining food. I mean people who really go all out, and there are plates, and there are plastic silverware, spoons, knives, forks. The people really do go all out at some of these larger tailgate events. But that said, it's all about the utility. It's all about, if you're going to make nachos and steak, just chop that steak up and put it on top of the nachos.
Yeah.
You don't need to have a separate thing. Like, make it something and put it in a bowl, or serve it in a way that your nachos aren't going to get soggy. Separate the ingredients as long as you can. There are things that people do, I think, that at tailgates are incredibly delicious. And I don't know that I really felt like this was a really, like Padma said, they're going to throw the best Super Bowl tailgate party. No, this wasn't even close. And I think this probably would have been better served by just having six chefs like make six dishes. I'm not ultimately sure why, if you're having a huge tailgate party like this, why you didn't do that. One of the best things about a tailgate, as you guys are talking about, sampling, nibbling, like having multiple kinds of food. I don't know why they just didn't do six things and call it a day. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I wonder if they're going for the teamwork aspect because of the football team. I don't know. I might be grasping at some straws here. And maybe the straws would be to sip up Fatima's mushy nachos that end up coming across. The blue and orange nachos with the rubbed chicken, the black lentils, cheese sauce, and a peach habanero salsa. Peach habanero salsa sounds interesting, bringing some, like, I guess, fruit-like aspects to nachos, which is not usually the thing. But, yeah, I mean, I think they talk about this at judges' table. Like, if you do nachos, something as simple as nachos, it better be the best damn nachos they've ever had. And it's clear that it wasn't. And I feel like we're talking about the myriad of reasons why Fatima went home over Joe Stash. I feel like that might be one of them as well, compounded with the fact that because this was her dish and her dish alone, she takes full responsibility, whereas you might be able to give Joe Stash some credit for helping out with the ribs, considering that him and Adrian shared the dish together. Antonio, you let out an exasperated sigh when I mentioned the nachos. Do you have anything else to say about them?
Nachos for exasperated sigh. No, I feel bad about the way that all played out. I think Fatima didn't, as we've talked about, didn't really know everything like about the tailgate. And the first thing that popped into her head was nachos, and she went with it. And it just, it didn't play out well. The sogginess of it is a major factor, and that's problematic, and it's sad to see. And my heart goes out to her because it was not fun to watch, as Haley has intimated.
Yeah, Haley, I'm gonna unfortunately, you know, rendered your heart just a bit more, and not just by eating all the grease that comes with some of these dishes. Talk to me about your thoughts on how the nachos came out.
It just didn't come out well. I thought nachos was probably a poor choice because they're prone to get soggy, like, pretty quickly too. And if you're serving it to a lot of people like that, it's just something that's hard to avoid. I think what they could have done was maybe go into the poutine direction, which is like do it on potatoes, or, you know, like a really thinly cut, I don't know if you guys have them there, but like a cactus cut nacho, where it's like potato and it's pretty crispy and really flavored, kind of spicy. Like, they would have been better suited to do something like that, where it's not going to get as mushy, because like potato is just generally a little softer than a nacho, so it's, you're not going to lose the integrity of the structure of the food as much as you would here. And she put a lot of heavy ingredients on the chicken, the lentils, the peppers, the sauce, the salsa. It's like, there's a lot on there, and she could probably cut back one or two things.
Do you think that she would have been better suited? I mean, I think she has a couple options here, right? I thought she was going to be dinged or have a problem because she just bought store-bought tortilla chips, and she could have in her prep made tortilla chips. And I don't know to what extent that's in her skill set, but I thought, you know, well, you're buying tortilla chips instead of making your own, that could cost you. So that, I think that's the first option, is she could have made her own chips. And I don't know if that would have changed the soggy element or not. The second thing is, you're serving it on one plate. You could put the chips on the side and put everything else, in one section and say, like, those chips are for that, you know, dip your chips in the mixture. That's how nachos are often served.
And it doesn't even make any sense to me that that there was two proteins on this dish.
Like, that's a really good point.
I don't get why it wasn't considered to just put Bruce's steak on the nachos.
We're back to this again, but you're right.
Or cut the steak really thin and almost do like steak nachos instead of having.
Tell me more. I'm excited about that idea.
Okay.
Yeah, like cut it really thin and then just have like the ingredients on there, and you can almost like roll it up and have it like that rather than even F with the nachos.
Yeah, I mean, if
interesting,
it might. Yeah. I don't know if in your work you have uncovered how this happens, but it always interests me the pictures of the food that you see presented as like this is what was prepared, and it's always on a clean white plate with a white background, and it's like the best dressed version of what they made. Do you know if that is done contemporaneously and how so? Because the nachos, even on the plate in the like the screenshot from the TV show, look soggy, and they look risky in that regard because of what Haley was saying, so much being dumped on top. I don't know when they take those pictures or who's responsible for their food art in that regard, but it seems like no matter what, even when it at its best, this looks like a soggy mess.
From what you're speaking in terms of the quote unquote food porn camera, which is the term that they actually give to it, from what I believe, I mean, my experience was made it a little different when I attended, you know, the quick fire challenge that was here in New York. It was done live. And so they pretty much, once the dishes were done, they gave one to the judges and then they ran the other one back to the food porn camera to film it. I like to think it's relatively in the same timeline. I'm assuming it's just like the producers are another attendee of the tailgate. They'll gather up all the dishes, a serving of all the dishes. Maybe they'll clean it up a tiny bit if there's splotches here or there, and then they'll present them on the camera. I don't think it's necessarily a, okay, let's put these nachos aside, wait an hour, and then we'll film them. So I think the fact that, as you mentioned, they were already looking a little bit worse for the wear, I think just shows that the nachos might not have been the most utilitarian idea.
Yeah, and I just think for when it comes to a tailgate, like you're not always going to be just cooking like cooking just to order. Like you've made your mix, and you probably made it in a crock pot, or you probably made it on a grill, or you probably prepped it right there at a tailgate, and then you're putting it aside, and you're combining it later, or it's not something that's going to be so easy that that you can just wait on that. Like I just, again, it's no fault of Fatima's that she didn't really know about tailgate food, and what she knew, she did the best that she could. And again, I should point out that other than the fact that maybe there was some criticism that it was a little muddled, and that 50 bars in town would have better nachos, I don't think anybody said it didn't taste good.
So let's move on to this final dish then. We're going back to a collaboration between Adrian and Joe Stash. Fried mac and cheese with a miso glazed St. Louis style rib with kale slaw and a kimchi aioli. I'll say it at least looked really good. I don't know if it was the plating or anything with like the rib sticking out, but it looked great to me. Didn't seem like it tasted great though. Tom said everything went wrong with this dish. Haley, I know this is jumping a bit to the actual elimination. Were you surprised that this was not pegged more as the, you know, the worst dish out of all of them, and that Joe Stash should have gone home?
I was really, really shocked about judging as a whole, because two people, like one team won as like one, and they won a prize that they got to share or whatever. But then the bottom two came from the other two teams. Like I thought it should have stayed consistent and like the worst team been the bottom. And then, you know, by that, you would think that Adrian and Joe would have been the worst, because the ribs, I guess, were fine. I'm not a big ribs person, so that doesn't draw me in. Kale slaw, you know how I feel about kale. It can go F itself.
And fried mac porn camera.
And fried mac and cheese, which it would be the thing that would get me most about this dish. It sounded like it was the worst part. So it just it sounded like no part of this dish really came together. And maybe, like, so I'm not really sure how Adrian and Joe together weren't the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Antonio, do you have a possible explanation as to how that happened?
Ribs and mac and cheese, I think, make a little more sense to me than just a really well-prepared steak dish with chicken nachos, the double protein thing. So I do think there was a little more cohesion in their dish than the nachos and steak, and I think that might have been why they were ultimately not the one subject to going home. But if I'm not mistaken, this wasn't a situation. I might be misremembering. I'm not going to describe what I was doing when I was watching this episode, what basements were involved, what liquors were involved. I don't remember this being a situation where there were two winners and the team won and they both won. And then there was one bottom team and one of the two bottom teams went home. My understanding was there were four people on the bottom. One of them was subject to going home and they thought Fatima's nachos were the worst of the four things that were done. Now you can talk about, am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong. They didn't say a member of the worst team would go home. I think what Haley is suggesting is maybe a different structure to the challenge where it's, okay, a team wins, a team is the losing team, and you have two then in the middle.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me that one whole team won, but not one whole team lost.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, sorry. I was confused with what you were, but you're right 100%.
That's fair. A lot of things I say are confusing and drawn out.
Google Translate really screwed that up for me, and I apologize. But yeah, I think you're right. And I think that makes more sense. I think we would have seen a different dish from Bruce and Fatima if that rule changes as well. You could have it so that the losing team both are eliminated, or you could have it that the losing team, one of you is going home. But I still think in the latter scenario that you're describing, I still think Fatima would have been the one to go home. That said, would Adrian and Joe have lost? I don't know. I feel like across the board, maybe their food was probably like less liked. I don't know. I don't really remember people saying good or bad things about Bruce's steak. Like, I don't remember people saying, like, that steak was really good, but the nachos were soggy. I don't remember people saying the steak was really good. So maybe I'm crazy.
All they said was Bruce made the least amount of mistakes, and therefore he was safe from truly being considered for elimination. And then it comes down to something that I always turn to, like the quintessential Top Chef sort of juncture when it comes to these judging decisions, is you have two dishes. One was better cooked, but didn't necessarily fulfill the rules of the challenge. One was worse cooked or was a worse dish, but stayed with the rules of the challenge. And we've seen how it's played either way. I mean, one of the reasons why Brother went home and why Tanya went home is that they didn't necessarily cook the worst dish, but they didn't necessarily fulfill the rules of the challenge. And I think that once again sort of struck here, where, as you mentioned, I don't think Fatima made the best nachos, but the fact that I think they didn't really collaborate together on one dish, and the fact that they went for what they thought was a tailgate dish that didn't really work out, that really ended up working against them. I want to cut to judges' table here. We talked about Tom's real frustration with them at this point. And it's interesting. I've been noting on Reddit the past few weeks, they sort of have notated that this season is full of a lot of people making mistakes. They're pretty darn frustrated about that. I don't know. Haley, we've been along for this ride on the season at this point. Do you think it's been a season that's been fraught with mistakes, as Tom is alluding to?
I mean, I can't think of it as one that has had more mistakes than any other season. I feel like every season, every episode, somebody slips up. That's the point of the show.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that it was out of place for Tom to make those comments?
I mean, no, I can see where he's coming from, because last week we had one team that was kind of really not doing so hot. Then this week it just seemed like nobody really lived up to the expectations that they had put on them, especially this late in the game. So I can get why Tom's frustrated, but maybe he was just like out in the sun too long. He had too much beer at the tailgate, and then he got like day hungover.
I think he was thinking about Logan Paul still. I think it's in his head. Like, I think he's really like just like he can't sleep at night because he's thinking about, why do we have that idiot YouTuber on the show? Like, is this going to be the jumping the shark moment? And like, it couldn't have been worse for Top Chef with Logan Paul. It really couldn't have.
It could have been slightly worse if it had aired, or this video had gotten out, you know, like 2 days before, and they couldn't do anything to edit him out, and they just kind of had to play it.
Yeah, at least the John Besh stuff they were able to get out in front of. The Logan Paul stuff was just ill timing. Antonio, where do you come down on this idea? Do you think this is a season where people have made more mistakes than usual?
I don't know. I don't want to say more than usual. We have to keep in mind some recent seasons have included all-star casts or people that are really just crushing it. I don't know that they've made more mistakes than usual. I mean, even just looking at this dish or this elimination challenge, I do think that Joe Sasto made a mistake with the cornstarch. I think that was problematic. But if you're talking about the person who went home, their mistake was in conceptualizing the dish. I don't know that it was in the way the dish tasted, or they didn't overcook something, or they didn't make a simple mistake in preparation. It was a conceptual error. And that's a mistake, don't get me wrong. But how do you draw a circle around where that specific mistake was made? Look at Tanya's mistake, right? What did she do? She said the wrong number on a thing. She didn't cook anything incorrectly. So I think it's unfair to hold some of these mistakes against people, because they're not necessarily all the mistakes that are being made are not just simple mistakes. There's a lot wrapped up in what mistake was actually made. So I don't know. I do think that it's interesting that Tom basically said about Adrian and Joe's dish, let me tell you about what was wrong with that dish, everything, or whatever he said. And if everything was wrong, going back to what Haley was saying, I just don't get it, why this played out the way it did. But we weren't there. We didn't eat any of the food, and we don't really know. Tom's comment about Fatima's Nachos, there's 50 bars in town. Bars, he said. He didn't even say restaurants that would have better nachos. That's pretty damning, and I don't see how you walk that back. But again, it's not a mistake. It's just because they weren't good enough. I can't point to a mistake she made other than not making them better.
Yeah. Let's send Fatima off here before she goes to Last Chance Kitchen. I would say from a personality perspective, I really liked the cast this season, but she definitely stood out to me just between all the back and forth about the camping and the football and her wanting to be a social media mogul. We just found out so much fun stuff from Fatima. She was killer in confessionals. She was doing really, really well up until, you know, maybe arguably her front of house service last episode that, you know, a few episodes ago when Kurt and Haley and I were talking about who was poised to win, I think all three of us had said Fatima at one point. I thought she was doing really well consistently and just had a really bad challenge today. So it's sad to see her go. Haley, I will cede the floor to you. Send Fatima off however you'd like.
I'm so glad Fatima was a part of the season. She was just such a breath of fresh air and a piece of casting I don't think we get a lot. I love seeing young women on the show do exceptionally well. I love seeing women of color doing exceptionally well. And I thought Fatima did just such a stunning job of just being herself and being relatable. And we could see her struggles, but we could also see her triumphs. And she was so fun and fun-loving. And it was clear everyone around her just adored her. So I'm so sad to see her go. And if there's an All-Stars coming in the next couple seasons, I would love to see her there and see how she's progressed.
Yeah. And I think I'm going to give her major kudos. I know she said she had reservations about coming in and cooking Pakistani food because she wasn't sure how she could serve as an envoy for a cuisine that not a lot of people are really used to. But I feel like she did her culture proud. I think she even said, like, this reinforced a lot of faith in the food that I wanted to cook. I feel like it was great to cast her not only for her personality, but the fact that, as you mentioned, Haley, she was highlighting a type of cuisine that not a lot of people know about. And I'm happy she was able to really bring a positive connotation to it. And also, of course, with everything that happened after the show, from what I've been able to glean in terms of updates, you know, she's out of surgery. She seems to be recovering, at least recovering enough to be able to talk with me. So I think that speaks towards her health. I know that Joe Flam visited her. Padma has really been by her side the entire time, which I find super sweet, especially when we see Fatima in the first episode really go gaga over Padma, considering that she grew up, you know, watching her cooking shows and now she gets to cook for her. To see them foster such a genuine friendship is really uplifting. And I'm so, so glad that she's doing well health-wise. Let's segue into Last Chance Kitchen here. Haley, I know you watched this week and you must be certainly glad you're watching it this week, because I'm sure we're talking about a subject that is near and dear to your heart. We are talking tacos on Last Chance Kitchen.
Yeah. So thank you, Michael, for the reminder, who messaged me yesterday, said, hey, don't forget to watch Top Chef. I was like, okay, I won't. I'm going to do it right now. Tacos are my all-time favorite food. If I was told I could only eat one thing for the rest of my life, obviously I'm picking tacos because you can have so many different kinds of tacos. Anyway, I thought this was a very interesting Last Chance Kitchen, what's it called, challenge. But it made me very anxious at the same time, because they didn't just have to like make a dish. They had to make a bunch of components for a dish. And then Tom selected which of those components he wanted for the tacos. So you really had to make sure that every element that you're making worked together with the other things. You couldn't make like, oh, well, if he does this, this, and this, well, that'll work. But if he does this, this, and that, that's not going to work. You had to, well, it was a very like mental gymnastics kind of challenge. They had 30 minutes, which seemed like a short amount of time to make a bunch of components.
Yeah, Antonio, give me your thoughts on this concept of the challenge. As Haley mentioned, this idea that, and we saw this, you know, as soon as the last Chance Kitchen challenge last season, where it was Brooke versus Casey, cook two dishes and I'll pick one. Here, it's make as many components as you want, but I will pick and choose. We'll make a full-out taco bar. I'll pick and choose what I want to put on my plate.
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought that was great. And it was the choices that Tom made were interesting as well. The things he didn't include, it seemed like he left out acid elements, maybe because I think the smart thing to do in that regard, it seemed like the chefs all pretty much did it, which is if you've got an element like acid that's important, you can't just have it be in one thing, because then he might not pick the thing and you might be missing that element from your dish. So I do think leaving it up to Tom is fine. I love tacos like Haley loves tacos. I'm on the same exact team in that respect. And I echo everything that Haley said about that. I find it interesting that it wasn't really connected to Fatima's Nachos or to that choice that was made, because a lot of the time these Top Chef challenges are connected. This one, it's a little harder because two people were sent home in one episode, but I just don't know. Taco bar. It's like, oh, well, you could literally do that any week of Top Chef. And as a matter of fact, now that I'm thinking of it, make this every Last Chance Kitchen. Just make it a taco bar every single time, and I'm cool with it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it was because of this idea that they were making it for multiple people, because for the first time in quite some time, the Peanut Gallery gets to join in on the taco bar. So maybe because they got to do that with the tailgate, maybe it's a similar idea. I'm not entirely sure, but as Haley said, the idea of a taco, and Tom even encourages this, go in any direction that you want to. So Brother goes for the traditional Tex-Mex layout, Fatima decides to stick with the Pakistani layout, and Joe Flam goes for Korean, which again just shows the wide repertoire that he covers. You know, he worked in a Korean restaurant for some time, so he decides to go for some of those flavors. Haley, as, you know, one of our big taco connoisseurs, if you will, of those three... thank you. Of those three, which one stood out to you the most?
I would, again, I don't think bias is coming to play here, but I'd say Fatima's Pakistani kind of layout. That seemed really interesting and something I've never tried before. So I'd really love to try those flavors mixed together in a taco form.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Antonio?
I was bothered that Brother played it safe. Fatima's definitely sounded more interesting to me than Brother's. I'm a big Korean barbecue, Korean taco guy myself, so I was more interested in Joe's in theory. But also, when it comes to tacos, fish tacos are not my favorite. I would prefer a different protein ultimately with my tacos. The problem with fish tacos, and I mean, I don't. If you're not the biggest fan of fish to begin with, it's already a high hurdle. But the variance in quality can also be very significant. If you have a really good one, it's great, but you could also get a really poor one. And so I think the mental image is not there. So I was most excited by Fatima's, I would say, as well.
And it turns out that, again, it comes down to these minute details so late in the game. It seems like from what we were told, Fatima's was still really good, but what sent her to the Peanut Gallery over Brother was the fact that for some reason, she decided to, you know, instead of slicing her steak up or her meat up, much like Brother did, and much like you might find at, say, like Chipotle, she decides to instead put those slices in, maybe something that Haley would want in terms of that steak nacho, that literal steak nacho that her and Bruce could have done. And as a result, Tom just pulls a big old piece of steak out, and he wasn't a big fan of getting that mouthful. So that sends her home. So we're looking at some nice Top Chef truels from now on. It seems like we're going to have brother versus Joe versus whoever goes home next. Haley, I feel like for the past few weeks we've been talking about, could brother be someone to take it all the way? You know, he was surprisingly eliminated a few weeks ago. It would be interesting to see him sort of take it to the finals of Top Chef here. But I don't know. I think Joe Flam is going to be really, really tough competition. And I might have to put my pick on Flam at this point, just because he is so diverse and he's just such a solid chef that I could honestly see him make his way back into that competition easily.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. I liked brother for this, for making it back. But now that he's up against Joe, I don't know. It's hard for me to believe that anyone except maybe Bruce could cook their way out of a competition against Joe.
I think Carrie can do it. That's the only thing I think that could hold Joe back, is if Carrie somehow ends up in the quick fire. Her creativity and her confidence and her decision making is really shown through. And I think that, like with Chef Brooke, who gets inspired, and when she gets inspired, just crushes the quick fire, the quick fire queen. I think Carrie, when she has a creative idea and she's confident about it, she executes it really, really well. And I think that's something that people struggle with in the quick fire scenario. I agree, Haley, that Bruce's skill level is certainly sky high. But, I mean, put him in a situation where he can't cook with his style. And I do wonder if he's going to be able to, with the strictures of that challenge, outperform someone like Joe or Carrie, who maybe is going to be able to be more malleable in that regard. So I think that Carrie could possibly take Joe down, but I certainly think Joe is the clubhouse favorite. Otherwise, I would also be surprised if Carrie goes home before the scenario where she can get back in the competition. So,
we only have two episodes left before that happens, because we're already down to five. And I'm assuming what we're going to do is next episode is 5-4, down after that 4-3. Then someone comes back, and then we just get one person eliminated until the final. So not a lot of room for people to start filling up a LCK. But I do agree that if Carrie somehow ends up there, there's a very good chance of, you know, pulling that Brooke and coming back immediately. Antonio, any other things you want to say about the season or what you think may come with Top Chef Colorado as we start rounding the bend here?
One final thought on Last Chance Kitchen. I do think it's a little bit problematic. Not problematic, but it's a little confusing when it comes to judging without being able to eat the food, that Tom was just hammering Joe Flam for the tostada and made it difficult to eat. It made it hard to eat, blah, 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 blah. And the reason Fatima goes home is the same thing, is that her food is hard to eat because of a choice that she made in terms of how it was plated or how it was ultimately presented to her. To Tom. It seemed like Tom had a much bigger problem with the way the food was presented to him from Joe. So I really don't know how to say even if the problem is that he couldn't get steak in every bite like it was with brothers, the tostadas seem to be as problematic as that. So I don't know. It's always hard to tell. And I think you said, Mike, it was minute details ultimately that sent somebody home. I've enjoyed this season of Top Chef. I still think we haven't seen the Rocky Mountain oysters that were suggested. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. We have not. And I don't know. I mean, it seems like next week we're going in for a bit of a spookier challenge.
I'm all in on The Shining.
Ooh, I am all out on the spook.
Yeah, they're going to, it seems like, the Overlook Hotel, or at least the inspiration for the Stanley, Overlook Hotel. Yeah. And it looks like there's a twist as well, with Tom standing ominously in the kitchen. So maybe they want to add some spookiness to that with the experience you get in a haunted house when you reach into a bowl of grapes and you're told that they're eyeballs.
Disgusting.
Yeah. Oh, these are worms, and it's Cavatelli and Bruce.
And
is
then
like,
Padma gets really pissed off. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So I love it. I'm here for that. The Shining is amazing. It's an incredible, incredible movie. And the Stanley Hotel in Colorado was the inspiration for the Overlook Hotel. So anything they can do ultimately to tie into The Shining, I'm all in on. Does that mean we need an elevator full of blood gushing down the hallway?
Stop. I have a story to tell about The Shining next week. I feel like I've told it somewhere else before. I don't think it was here, but we'll get there next week. Mike, remind me.
Can't wait. I can't wait to hear that. I can't wait to hear that.
I will remind you, and I'll be very excited to hear it. Antonio, we've been loving having you on this episode. We missed you over the course of the podcast, so thanks for stopping by, much like, you know, these guest judges, to come and give your opinions. They've been very much appreciated, and I love hearing you get to talk about Top Chef and give your opinion.
It feels like being home.
Thank you. I'm happy to hear that. And I'm really thankful that you asked me to come on. And I'm not happy that it was because Kurt got so busy in his life that he had to drop it, because I know he loves it too. But I've had a really good time listening to you guys over the course of the season, and I've laughed a lot. And I think it's been great, Mike, that you have the access that you have and the events that you've attended. I think that's so cool for reality TV wrap-ups, for Parade, for you as a person, and for the podcast in general. I know you just did that Top Chef Junior one too, so it's really cool what you've been able to do.
Yeah, I'll talk briefly about this. Again, it's sort of adjacent to Top Chef. But I talked about this at the very beginning when we started doing this season. But Top Chef Junior is a spinoff that had been running on Universal Kids for the past several months. It was hosted by Vanessa Lachey, and the head judge was Curtis Stone, though they've had appearances from Gail and from other alumni. They just aired their finale this past Friday, and I was very lucky to get invited to an event where I got to go to the Black Barn restaurant in Manhattan, and I got to dine with the two finalists, who are both 13 years old, and Curtis Stone and Gail Simmons. I was very fortunate in my seating. I got to sit at the right hand of Curtis Stone for half the dinner, and then halfway through they swapped places and I got to sit right next to Gail. They're both absolutely lovely people to talk to, so engaging and so passionate about the show and about cooking. Ironically enough, Curtis Stone and I both ended up wearing nearly the exact same thing, so I felt like I was his uglier Jewish son that just happened to be sitting next to him at the table. But he made for really great conversation. I know Antonio asked me this offline, and I'll answer this for everyone out here. Yes, Curtis Stone is very, very tall in person. Quite the opposite of Bruce.
That's not what I asked you. I asked you what he smelled like.
He smelled very nice as well. I mean, granted, but we had a lot of odors coming because we were also seated at the chef's table, which was actually between like the dessert expo station and the main kitchen itself. I'll run down the dishes that we had briefly just because they were really, really fantastic. We started with some Bishop's carrots that had like this really nice piece of spicy granola in them. We had some foie gras over some buckwheat blinis. We had, my favorite dish was probably the monkfish over Padma's favorite food, cavatelli, with some specks of chorizo in there with clams, some nice braised bison short ribs with some celery root ribbons on the side. And for dessert, it looked like an arancini, but it was a big ball of fried chocolate ganache.
What?
Yeah. So when you crack into it, it just like,
God. Wow, that is
it
what
just
I want.
Oozed out.
Stop.
And it was over a coconut puree with some passion fruit.
Wow.
And that was inspired by Tide Pods, it sounds like.
Oh boy, exactly. The kids held them on their tongues for as long as they could. It was an incredible experience to get to talk with Curtis and Gail, because they come from an interesting perspective in that obviously Top Chef Junior had contestants who were aged 11 to 14. Gail and Curtis are both parents, so it was really interesting to hear their perspectives as to how they sort of had to serve as mentors as well. These are kids that come into the competition, you know, having read Thomas Keller's work or having studied, memorized recipes in a cookbook and know how to, you know, flambé something. But they don't necessarily have a POV. And something that I've really enjoyed about the series, which now you can catch up entirely on with the first season, because, you know, congratulations, Top Chef Junior has been renewed for a second season, so now you have all the incentive to catch up on the first season. You get to see over the course of the season them sort of gain their POVs. In fact, one of the kids who, spoiler alert, ended up winning, he started just like, I like French food, but he didn't know exactly what he wanted to cook, and he figured it out by the end. And it was so interesting to watch them both at the dinner, these two finalists, because they have such an unmitigated passion for food and cooking that it's so incredible to see at such a young age. I mean, I can't remember what I was passionate about at the age of 13, if I was passionate about anything as much as they were passionate about cooking, to the point of where like they were pretty reticent about talking about elements from their personal life or like school stuff. But once you put the plate in front of them and they just nerd out guessing like, okay, was this a sprinkle of black truffle? How did they prepare this? You know, let's talk about all these new pop-ups that opened. To see them so, at that age, just so into cooking when for years we've seen it become primarily an adult obsession was just so cool to watch in person. So thank you, Universal Kids, for giving me that opportunity. Thank you, Top Chef Junior, for really showcasing how cookery can start at such a young age and how you can foster such a passion for the culinary arts within someone. And yeah, definitely check out Top Chef Junior if you haven't already. I also wrote an article for Parade about my experience there, as well as I will be publishing my exit interviews with both Joe Flam and Fatima there. They both I had a really nice conversation with both of them as we segue into our final five contestants. Antonio, how can people follow you on social media? And I know you take a little bit of a break from podcasting, but I know we did something very recently that brought you back to the table.
Yeah, that maybe if people feel like they want to end up in the good place, they can listen to that. Yeah, we podcasted with Josh Wigler around the same time as this is being recorded about the NBC comedy, The Good Place, a show I highly recommend that you guys check out. If you haven't checked it out, don't read anything about it. Just go watch it. Yeah. We podcasted about that. You can always tweet at me if you want to invite me to an awesome event and have some free non-branded branded content. I'll put it on a podcast. Hit me up, AC Mazzaro on Twitter at AC Mazzaro, 2 Z's and 1 R. And that's how it works. But yeah, no, I really jealous of you, Mike, except for the monkfish part. Everything sounds amazing.
And Haley, how can people follow you on social media? I know outside of your typical bachelor fare, you have gone once again into the world of sports, much like this episode for another podcast, correct?
Yeah. So me and Akiva and Brent Walgamott joined us near the end. We talked about the Winter Olympics a couple years ago. We delved into the world of the Summer Olympics. And for some reason, people were asking if we were going to do a Winter Olympics one. So we said, oh, why not? So that should be out before the Olympics starts, hopefully.
No, make it after. It sounds like a good plan.
That would be fun to see if all of our predictions were wrong. But you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at @hstrong_.
Anything else about the bachelor's going all right?
Yeah, it's fine. You know, check us out there.
Is he the most boring bachelor of all time, Haley?
Yeah, and people are starting to get a little upset with me that I keep calling him so boring, but it's not my fault he's boring.
It's his parents' fault.
When does the Bachelor Winter Games start?
I want to say next week, along with the Olympics, but I'm not totally sure, so we'll see.
So maybe some bonus podcasts from Haley there, dealing with some more sports, but I don't know. We might put sports in quotations there.
And it's looking like we might have some fun guests for those shows, so keep your little eyes out for that. Mm.
And you can always follow me at a Mike Bloom type. You can check out the Amazing Race podcast and exit interviews that I'm doing. I also released for Parade some cast previews for both Celebrity Big Brother and Survivor Ghost Island, both of which released this past week. And I just recorded a really great episode of the RuPaul's Drag Race recap. Hella dramatic episode. We had a lot to talk about, myself, Liana Boris, and Brent Wolgamott. So be sure to check all that out. Thank you all so, so much for listening. Antonio, Haley, thank you so much for being here. Do we have a hashtag for people who made it all the way to the end of this podcast, the end of this football game length podcast?
I didn't write one down. Haley, you're so good at this. Do you have anything?
I'm only good at saying things that make the hashtag. I'm not good at remembering what I said.
The one that I wrote down was flambe.
Yeah, I love that.
So is it FLAMMBAE, right?
Yep, yep. Okay. I think so. So we are butchering any sort of French, much like a two butchered that poor lamb several episodes ago. But yeah, we'll go with flambe.
Let two go, Mike. Let him go. Don't bring that back.
No, never. It's too late to let him go. But reach out with hashtag flambe. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back with another fun guest talking about Top Chef episode 10 of season 15. But for now, you may pack your knives and go.